Thank you all for joining us this morning, or it's almost afternoon. I'm Liz Bowles, Associate Director of the Tri-Lab Program. And today I have sort of the pleasure, that honor, to introduce Skippy Weinstein to you. Just want to give you a little background about him. It's sort of an easy background to do, because if I just mention everything that a lawyer wants to achieve in their life, I pretty much hit on all the things that he's achieved. He's a litigator's litigator. I've heard him call himself a street fighter. I've heard him call himself basically just a litigator at heart. That's exactly what he does. It's what his passion is. He was a graduate of WCL 1965. Am I correct in that? 1965. He's been a litigator ever since. He's done everything from federal, state litigation, criminal, civil, complex litigation, insurance defense, simple small cases at $50 to $100, trying out, you know, three or four of them in a week's time. He's sort of done it all. And one of the things that you have at the end of your career, and you get to look back and you get to think about all the people that you've represented, the stories that you've told in closing arguments, and one of the best things about spending time with Skippy is you actually get to hear about some of those cases, and I think each one of them has sort of made him who he is today, so he's a delight to talk to. Some of his accolades, just to sort of put them in comparison to anyone else I know. He has sort of the accolades of 5-6 accomplished lawyers. So he's been a super lawyer for decades. He's on the Electoral College in New Jersey. He's voted 3 times as an electoral delegate. He is someone who has been on the cover of 4 magazines. He's been, a story of his life is written by the New York Times. He's the man they call when they want someone to comment on a case. He's that guy. He's the one you see on TV. He's the one that you see interviewed and quoted, giving his insights into different litigation and different strategies that different counsel uses in the presentation of their cases. So it's an absolute honor to have him here today to talk to us. And so we figure after he has an opportunity to sort of just give you some insights, he's also going to take questions. So be thinking about things you'd like to know about career and litigation. You can really ask him just about anything. And he's going to have some experience to be able to give you some insight on it. So thank you and welcome.
Certainly an ego is a terrible thing to waste. You know, what's wonderful about today is I look out and I see each and every one of you, and I know that the vast majority of you want to ultimately become trial lawyers. And to me, that is probably one of the most exciting parts of my life, other than my wonderful wife of 52 years and children and grandchildren. So I want to talk about being a trial lawyer. I'm not going to talk to you today about the academics. I'm going to talk to you today about the real world, preparing for a courtroom and actually trying the case. One of the things that I'm always asked is, what was one of the most exciting cases that you ever had? I'm from New Jersey, and I tried cases in New York and New Jersey. And I, as many of the trial lawyers in those states and other states as well, after 9/11, were asked to represent some of the families. I'm going to tell you a story that was very moving to me, and I want to share this bit of information to you, because this is what being a trial lawyer is all about. It's the actual love of the people that you're asked to represent. And whether or not I represent a brain-damaged child as a result of malpractice for a nurse, a doctor, a hospital, or whether or not I'm trying to save somebody's life on a death penalty case, the fact of the matter is you have to feel what their feelings are. I will tell you the 9/11 story. I couldn't figure out for the months that I was asked to represent this Korean family. And the beautiful part of the story was that he, the individual, a very nice man who died, fell in love with this wonderful woman in Korea. And he was invited to come over and work for Fitzgerald. And he loved this woman and kept going back to Korea, and he kept
asking her mother and her father about marrying her. And they said no, too far. And he created a brochure of his love for her. And in the last page, he presented her with a flower and asked her to marry him. And they had the most beautiful love affair. And on this particular day, he had been married, and they had two little girls. And he was in charge of the technical aspect of Fitzgerald. And he had a cold and a fever. And his wife said, "Why don't you stay home? You don't feel well." And he said, no, I have to go and I have to figure out to finish." And he left that day. They said goodbye to each other. He kissed his children goodbye. But you never heard from him again. And that was one of the cases that I was asked to represent the family. I was going into New York that day to try the case. I couldn't figure out what my opening would be. And we're driving down the New Jersey Turnpike, and we pass this wonderful lady. She's holding up something that, of course, you know. And it just came to me. And I said to myself, my client wanted to fulfill a dream, as did my family. And that dream involved providing for his family in a new country. And that hit me. And about an hour later, I was in that courtroom and I was opening, and that was my opening. I tell you this story for this reason. You have to feel in your heart. There's an old Yiddish word. Gesundheit is not the word. The word is Rachmanis. Rachmanis. What that means is you have to have a heart. And if you have a heart and you represent these people, that you come to have a very significant relationship. So on that day, and of course we waived all our fees, and afterwards, the family who came in from Korea, the mother, it was an unbelievable situation. Their gift to me, which was overwhelming, they took me out for coffee and chocolate chip cookies, which you can observe I really enjoyed. But that's the pride of being a trial lawyer. John Grisham writes books about lawyers. And a buddy of mine who I grew up with in the South Ward of Newark, we've been friends for many, many years. He sent me this because he knew that I was coming here to have the privilege of addressing each and every one of you. I want to read something to you because this is something that you all someday are going to be asked. And the question is, I'm quoting John Grisham in Sycamore Row on page 411. Why in the world do you want to be a trial lawyer? When you try a case, you lose sleep and wait each night? Yeah, I think so. My point is that trial work is so stressful. Why do you want to do it? Because I love it. It's what being a lawyer is all about. Being in the courtroom in front of a jury is like being in the arena or on the field. The competition is fierce. The stakes are high. The gamesmanship is intense. There will be a winner. There will be a loser. There is a rush of adrenaline each time the jury is let in and seated. A lot of ego? A ton. You'll never meet a successful trial lawyer without an ego. It's a requirement. You've got to have the ego to want to work. And that's what each and every one of you are looking forward to. There are things that you have to remember when you walk into that courtroom. Don't talk down to jurors. Talk to them. They're wonderful people. They're on the same level as you, except you have a JD degree from a great college, I might add. And when you talk to them so that they understand what you're saying. Tell them the strength of your case. Share with them the weaknesses so that the jury appreciates that you're being candid and honest right from the outset. And in that way, they immediately have respect for you and ultimately your position. Know how to dress. There was a lawyer in New Jersey who I was very fond of, and he was very successful, trial lawyer. And his name was Rocco, the last name's not important. And he had a Rolls Royce, convertible. I said to him one day, I said, Rocco, I said, the theory among us is that we dress down. We don't dress up. You don't go into a courtroom with a Rolex. You don't have initials all over you, you know? You don't do that. I said, why in God's name would you be driving a Rolls Royce and parking the damn thing in front of the jury? I mean, it's almost in front of the courthouse. And he came up with an answer. I don't agree, but he came up with an answer. He said, I want to show the jury, if they see it, that I've been very successful and that I recover a lot of money for my clients. I don't subscribe to that theory. I go the other way. New Jersey, we have 21 counties. Each county has its own personality. There's some counties in which you know, I just finished a case involving a Vietnamese person, turnpike accident, loss of a leg on the site. And I looked at the jury, and 5 out of 8 were Spanish-speaking from countries, Central South America, one from Mexico. And you have to pay respect to their culture. And that you can't go in there to show off how successful you've been. You have to dress down. And it's not only that county, Hudson County, if any of you know Hudson County, a New Jerseyan, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There you go. We talk alike? All right, good. You have to pay respect that you're asking these people, some of which make $45,000 to $60,000 a year, and they think that's a lot of money, and it may be. But you have to remember, you're asking these people to award this person who also came in seeking a dream fulfilled. That was the Vietnam person. So you don't show off this. I had a lawyer one time, an adversary, good lawyer. He was using words that I have to tell you something. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Now, okay, I grew up in the South of New York. I'm a high school dropout, which you probably already know. I was in reform school for 2 years, tattoos on my arms. I remember was, I guess you never lose it, a member of the Royal Knights in Newark. Okay, let's get through that nonsense. But talk to people. Talk to them. Don't talk down to them. I mean, who the hell are you to talk down to people? These are human beings. They don't want to be there. The jurors don't want to be there. They want to be home or doing something, but they sure as hell don't want to be there sitting and making judgment. And therefore, you have to be able to know your audience, so to speak. And when you have a case that has a lot of compassion, I've tried many brain damaged baby cases, and I'm sure many of you know what this is. This is where the doctor, nurse, or the hospital has screwed up. And the child is not delivered in time, comes out in a major problem. And I finished this 6-week trial in Newark. And this child was so badly damaged that everything was wrong with this child, but she was still alive. And the father said to me, "She hears me." I said, "Doctors say she's deaf." He said, "Skippy, she knows when I'm there. Now, she's deaf, she's blind, she's paralyzed, she's quadriplegic, she has no gag reflex. We go to trial. And we try the case for 6 weeks, jury was out for a week. And lo and behold, my last witness before the onslaught of doctors for the defense, I went through the entire plaintiff's case, produced my experts, et cetera, et cetera. I had 5 out of 8 African-American jurors, 1 Czechoslovakian, an immigrant, and the other 2 were Caucasian, from, et cetera. And in comes, in this wheelchair like this, this child. And the defense in this case was that she really doesn't have a quality of life. And she really can't feel, hear, know anything. And the father said to me, "Skippy, I can get her to react." I said to him, "All the doctors say, you did. And you never call a witness that you don't know what they're going to say. Never. And I'm telling you, I just violated the Skippy rule." And I bring this little girl in a wheelchair. And the jury is here. Sit her here. Said to the father, "Can she hear you?" And he said, "No." I said, "What is it that you are going to show this juror that she knows I'm there?" And I said, "Can you do that for us?" And he said, "Yes." He comes up behind her, the judge is here. 2 defense lawyers are over there. I'm here. Step back quietly. It's not me now. It's this little girl. He comes up behind her and he goes, "Honey, I love you, I love you, I love you." And she goes, and I said, "Judge, I have no other questions." And the juror started to cry. Judge said, "Would you all like a reason?" They said, "Yes." But you have to feel it here. And you have to take that feeling and you have to give it to the jury. And that's what trial law is all about. Now, my suggestion, you have wonderful people, Liz and Liz are great, and giving you direction and help and educating you. But I'm going to give you some practical advice. So forgive me if it's more practical than academic. I'm not an academician. Growing up where I did, I'm lucky I could read and write. The fact of the matter is this. If you want to be a trial attorney, then you have to get practice and you have to do it. Yes, what we did today with Liz for the hour plus was great. You guys did super. And I'll answer any questions that you have after. Well, a limited amount of questions. There were some things I don't answer. Now, but what you have to do is you have to figure out, what do you want to do? Where do you want to work? I know jobs are tough, very tough out there now. What you want to consider is something like this. When I went out, we were married, and started to have a child a year. Father finally bought me the TV. And ultimately, what happened was, I worked for Hartford Insurance Company. And I went to court every Monday morning in Bergen County, where I was assigned, and I had a valise full of cases. One case could be worth $50, another one $150. But you know something? It didn't matter. Because I didn't care if the case settled or didn't. In fact, I had hope it didn't settle. Why? Because I could try another case. And that first year, there were about 17 of us that they assigned to different counties in New Jersey. And each of us just wanted to try cases. That's all we wanted to do. That's what we did. So my thought to you is this. Think about working for an insurance company. You don't get paid a hell of a lot of money. But you can get the experience taking depositions, doing interrogatories, handling notices to produce. All of these things are very significant. Number two, think about state and federal government. Talk about doing things like either a prosecutor, a U.S. attorney, because all of these provide you with the opportunity to get into a courtroom, stand up. Our son is a lawyer, has been for many years, graduated from here, pictures back there some years ago. And he has gone on to work for a very large firm, a couple of hundred lawyers. And what he does is he does white-collar crimes in New Jersey and New York in the federal and state system. And Washington College of Law provided him with that mechanism to be able to learn that and do it. So he was with Janet Reno for 5 years in her office. And he goes to her and he says to her, I would like to try cases. Is it okay? And she sends him down to the district court and she says, try him. He tried, I think it was 22, Nancy, 22 in a row. He tried 22 cases in a row, picked the jury, lost. Picked a jury, won, picked a jury, bang to bang to bang. And that's how we learned how to try cases. So I say to you, you've got to get in that courtroom. And either it's federal or it's state. And whether or not in New York or New Jersey you have the county DA or you have a state attorney general's office, wherever it is, apply and get a contact. You know, I'm always asked questions about, how do you get a job? Years ago, it used to be by colleges and law school and sanding and all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you something. That's BS today. That is. That's nonsense. The way you get a job today is you have to have a contact. And that's the absolute, I'm sad to say it to you. And I hope this is not being recorded. But that's the truth. The fact of the matter is you have to have somebody make a call. And don't hesitate to do it because it could impact on your future life. And that's important. You know, doing trial work is very difficult for a family. I would get up 4:35 in the morning. I would prepare my notes for the day. I would come home. I'd go back to the office, of course. God forbid I miss a call. And I stay there till 7:30. I would go home. My wife and I would have dinner 8:30 at night. I'd study till 11:30. Get back into bed. Boom. And I'd start again. And that's very hard for a family.
hard for kids, and it's hard for a spouse. But if that's what you want to do, it's a whole lot of fun, I got to tell you. When you see that jury coming in, and there are 50, 75 of them, and you know that you either win or lose with some of those people. And what you have to do, and I don't know if, Liz, it's okay that I talk about this, but you got to face
it.
Everything's okay. Oh, boy, don't say that to me. What you do is you face that jury, and you watch them. And you watch if they look at you. And you watch what they wear. And you watch what they carry. And you see the newspapers, and the books, and the magazines. And you look at their fingers to see if they're smokers. And you see if they wear a tie. And you look at those things. I was just retained, I think about 2 weeks ago. Very sad case, an alcoholic killed somebody on the highway and maimed someone else. And he had no suit, and his family had hired him. And he had no clothing to wear to court on first appearance. So I go, I take him to court because I knew the press was going to be there. He walks in with a suit. And we talked about Rachmanis before. So he walks in with a suit. And I looked at him and I said, where'd you get the suit? I thought you didn't have a suit. He kind of smiled. He said, yeah, he said, I want to look nice. I said, okay. And his sister turns to me and she said, we bought it for $8 at the Salvation Army. And another sister sewed it so that he could wear it. Because that's up to you, as trial lawyers, to make sure that you present your client. And it's also up to you to know what county you're in. And you have to be prepared knowing the background of that county. Now, one of the things that become very important is when you represent criminally, I'll talk about that for a moment. Talk about someone who you represent, finished a four-week trial, and it was an accusation of a man, at that point he was in his 50s, no, actually he was in his 40s, and he was living with a woman who had three small daughters, and it was a terrible sex crime. I won't even tell you about it. It was absolutely horrible. I represented him, and I kept saying to myself, I don't give a damn about the money. I'm here to defend the Constitution. That's why I'm doing this. And the press had it every day on the front page. I mean, it was absolutely horrible what went on. You could have gotten them 9 months if they had to bring witnesses in from London, et cetera, et cetera. They had 100 videos of these girls doing things to him. I said to him, they got you, babe. Really that simple. I can get you 9 months. 9 months! I said, if we go to trial and you lose the case, I said, you're going to get 10, 15, 20 years. Well, the judge who I had known, former prosecutor himself, we tried the case for those number of weeks, and every objection that was made, he ruled in my favor. And after about the 10th in my favor ruling, I said to myself, he knows I'm going down. And he is protecting that record to make sure that when the appellate division looks at his sentencing, because he is going to whack him, it's going to be affirmed. And sure enough, he was convicted, hello. And lo and behold, he sentences him to 30 years. He could have had 9 months. He turns to me. I mean, there's an old Yiddish expression of what a schmuck is. And he turns to me. And he says to me, you did a hell of a job. I looked at him and I said, excuse me, you lost. You're going away. He said, but yeah, you put up one hell of a fight. I said, do you realize you could have had 9 months? He says, I'm Irish,
and I never give in, and I fight till the end. I said, okay, as long as you feel that way, that's fine. But you know you're going to get sentenced real heavy. And he said, yep. And he wrote a letter to us after his sentence, thanking us, pointing out that we were very compassionate and things like that. So, you know, you scratch your head and you say to yourself, look, you did the best thing you could. You defended the Constitution, because that basically is what it was. It's a horrible situation. And you have to make decisions when you take and accept cases. If you're with the public defender, which many of you will be or work for now, the difficulty with agencies like the public defender is they have wonderful lawyers, not enough lawyers, but they don't have proper time to pay investigators. And what happens is a defendant just gets kind of shuffled through the system. And there's statistics to talk about what happens in the end when you don't have proper representation. Not the lawyer's fault, I want you to know that. But it's the fact that if a lawyer for the public defender may have 300 cases, you cannot possibly get involved in a trial that could take a week because you'd be so backed up in your work and you need to move these cases through. In fairness, but I tell you, you want to try cases? Think about the public defender. It's a great opportunity. They need lawyers to do that. Think about the DA's office, state's attorney, Florida, whatever they call it down there. One of the things that I do is when I know I'm going to try a major case, I find out where my adversary or adversaries are on trial. I go there. I watch them. I want to see them. I want to see what they do. I want to see where they stand. I want to see how they speak. I watch them. And I mean, I've been doing this a while. You know, it's more than 2 weeks. And the guys see me, and the ladies and the women, they see me, and they say, watching me? And I give them the answer, yes, I am. And therefore, I know how they're going to react. Because most of these people, I've tried cases against for years. But that's what you got to do. You want to know not only who your adversary is, you want to be able to understand how that adversary handles him or herself. You know, I had a great time from 10 to 11:30. And there was a question in that case relative to a fractured hip. And one of the things that you may not know, but I kind of talked about it for 10 seconds. I'll just bring it up now. I represented a man many years ago who fell and fractured a hip. He was 30 years old. And the doctor who created the hip replacements was a doctor in London by the name of Charnley. They don't call him Dr. Charnley, they call him Mr. Charnley. So this David White, who fell in Morristown, interestingly enough, around the courthouse, block away, he goes back to England where he was from, and Dr. Charnley did a hip replacement on a 30-year-old. Never done it before, this was the first person. Well, I needed evidence. I had to go to London. But before I took the testimony of the surgeon, I needed to understand the mechanism of a hip replacement. So he gives me one of his lieutenants, and he teaches me how to replace a hip surgically. And now I'm going to take the testimony. And I knew how to remove a hip. I saw it. I watched it. And I learned about the acetabulum and the greater trochanter and the small trochanter and the femur. I mean, I knew all about it. But that's what you got to do. I'm not suggesting every case you go to London, but the fact of the matter is, you have to know what your damages are if you're doing personal injury cases. Plaintiff and defendant. You got to know it. You got to understand it. So when someone says, you know, I have a foot drop as a result of spine surgery, you have to understand that the spinal cord has neurons that innervate this way, and it goes down to certain parts of your body. And depending upon where the surgery was done and the nicking of that cord or that neuron can cause a foot drop. Well, you don't get foot drops unless there's negligence, which is a term for malpractice. And therefore, you have to know that, and you have to study that. And that's what being a good trial lawyer is. But you have to love it. You can't simply just do it to make a living. You can't do it. It eats you up inside. But you have to feel that love inside for that family and that person. I think it was about 13 murder cases to verdict. And I tried death penalty cases. When I was a prosecutor, I was second chairing on electrocution case, trying to put this bad person to the chair. And as a defense lawyer, I tried the death penalty case as well. And one of the judges said to me during the trial, my picture was on the front page of some newspapers, he calls me in and he says to me, "Skilling, when this case is over, take Nancy and go away for a couple of days." He said, "You look like hell." I used to like it. Your demeanor in a courtroom, to me, is very important. One of the murder cases I tried was against a prosecutor who, for some reason, felt the need to pound tables and to kick a table. He did. I looked at him like, "Are you a damn fool?" I was making points. I was. And he got up to cross-examine, and the answers were not what he wanted. And he said, "Are you telling me?" Bang, and he bangs on the table. And he told me, "That's ridiculous," and he kicks the table. Looking at this guy like, "Are you crazy? I mean, what are you doing, man?" And lo and behold, that was his style. But I knew it. And another thing that you have to do is you have to pay respect to the jury. For some reason, I learned this from one of the justices of the Supreme Court of New Jersey, who I used to try cases against. He used to memorize and taught me to memorize the names of every juror that's in the box. So I would stand there and I would say something about, "Let me tell you what this case is about, Mr. Jones, Ms. Smith, Ms. that, and go right, I didn't have a note, not a note in my hand. And that jury would sit there and look at me. That was impressive, okay? But the fact of the matter was that they felt that was out of respect to them. Now, when you're in Passaic County in New Jersey, there are towns where there is a large Polish-Russian population. And I was getting down to that juror. And he was looking at me because he wanted to see if I pronounced his name right. And I turned to him and I said, "And Mr. Trashinsky," and he went, "It didn't mean a damn thing what that testimony was. I got him with me." But you got to know that. You got to do it. You got to do your own style. You have to create what's good for you. What I'm telling you now is good for me and some of the lawyers in my office. But you have to do it yourself. You have to feel it. You have to create it. You have to feel comfortable with it. When I was a law clerk many, many years ago, I used to go into the courtroom and I used to watch the lawyers. And I watched them because I wanted to know what to do, and I also wanted to know what not to do. And by doing that, you can create in yourself what's comfortable for you. Always be respectful to the court. If you disagree with the judge, okay, you disagree. The judge ruled, go on. That's all, out of respect. With your Honor's permission, may I approach? Your Honor, may I approach the witness? Your Honor, we've pre-marked this document. Would you mind if I presented it to the witness? Always respect. And, you know, some of the juries have been interviewed after a verdict. And the question that are asked of them is, what did you think about A, B, and C? And I remember more than once, I have had jurors tell the judge in turn told me, he says, Skippy, they felt so awed by your respect for them and the court. Plug that into your thinking. Because if that what impresses the jury, then that's what you have to do. Do it your own way. But that's what you have to do. One of the privileges of practicing for a while, and I'm going to close this down so you can ask me anything you wish, is throughout the years we have reported cases. And I've been before the Supreme Court. I represented judges and lawyers before the court. But we have about, I think I have now 45 or 46 reported cases out of New Jersey. And that's very interesting. That makes me very proud. Because each of those cases, and I'll tell you only about the last one, I was asked to represent someone who was in a bad accident. It was a truck on the wrong side of the road. The motorcycle took off the leg of the husband right on the spot. Took off the leg of the wife that was off but still attached by some stick. And I found that in the discovery, and you have to take, and please, please, listen to this. If nothing else what I say, listen to this. In any case, civilly, you have got to take the depositions of every single witness that's coming into that courtroom. You have got to know what that witness is going to say. You have to have that witness's testimony. And you have to know what you can do to cross-examine that witness. So back to my story. I'm asked to represent the husband and wife who lost their legs. And during the discovery period, I inquired about what was he doing when he was driving the car. And I found out that he was texting. Well, I don't sleep well during these cases. And I got up the next morning, I turned to my wife, and I said, I have an idea. She used to me already. And I said, why shouldn't a remote texter, not in the vehicle, but a remote texter, knowing that the person receiving the text is driving, and knowing that that's illegal, why wouldn't that person be civilly responsible? I thought about it. I go back to my office, and we sit around sometimes when we're all on our trial or doing it there. And I said, you know, guys, I had this thought at 3:50 this morning. I didn't call you, but I thought about it. And I tell them the story. They say to me, it'll never be. Can't happen. Well, you don't tell a high school dropout it's not going to happen, because things have happened that shouldn't have happened. And lo and behold, we just won in New Jersey, the first case that holds a remote texter responsible when they have knowledge that the recipient of that texting message is operating a motor vehicle. So I lost by summary judgment. The defense moved to get the homeowner, the remote texter, out. I lost. And the judge, after ruling, called me up and he says to me, Skippy, I want to tell you something. I felt like saying, yeah, you should have told me here, big record, right? And he says to me, I think you're going to win this on appeal. I said, thanks. He retires, moves to Virginia. Big hug, right? So you go to the appellate division, and it's usually a 15-minute argument. And they have three judges, usually they don't. So they have three judges, and I'm up there 45 minutes, and they're shooting questions at me. And what you may have gathered is, I enjoy this. I have fun doing this. I make a living, but I have fun doing this. And they're coming at me, boom, boom, boom. And I don't hear anything, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. And we're on vacation up in Cape Cod. And I get a call. Congratulations. What do you mean? You won. The appellate division created a cause of action for liability with remote texting. But they didn't give you the ability to get damages because in this case they felt that the tie-in was not enough. So I had to figure out what to do. Do I appeal? I'm not going to bore you with why we didn't and all that kind of stuff. So what happened was I did 14 radio programs and 3 or 4 TV programs in justifying the law. But I tell you this for this reason. Think beyond the envelope. Because that helps the public. And it helps the people with safety. And we have created cases and laws. I won't give you other examples. But all of which, well, I will give you one. When you have a tractor that is digging and it has to come back the dig, it has outriggers, okay? So we argued, I had a client that was decapitated with the thing going back. We argued that there had to be a buzzer, a bell, a noise, so that you could hear it over all of the other sounds in a construction site. And you know, guess what OSHA ultimately said? I lost the case. Right, frankly, I lost it. But the fact of the matter is, it's now the law. And all of these construction areas are hopefully saving people's lives. I can't take credit for that. But that's what we do as trial lawyers. And that's what I would like you to do. Someday, and someday soon. Thank you. I guess now is the time for questions. Do we have a few minutes?
We do. Absolutely. Do you have any questions?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hey, Mr. Watson. First, thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate you taking the time to come in and speak with us. But what advice would you give someone who wants to practice outside of the D.C. area and wants to do trial work?
I think that, where are you going? What state?
Chicago.
Illinois.
Where are you going? I only want to do Chicago.
Chicago's still part of Illinois, though, right?
Last time I checked, it was.
Well, Emmanuel is working hard out there, so
yes.
You have to find a place in either private firm that does litigation or government. If you have a political connection, try to work for the city of Chicago. And that's where you have to get your experience. I'm going to say something, and I hope I don't offend anybody who either they, their spouse, their relationship, whatever. If you want to do trial work, don't work for a company that's going to have you do contract reading or amendments on merger or acquisition. That's absolute nonsense for a trial lawyer. If you have a contact in Chicago, which I suspect you may, make that contact and get interviewed by the city of Chicago. They have their own DA office within the city. Go there. Public defender. They're busy as hell. You don't make a lot of money, but you get great experience. I think I had, what did I have? We had 3 or 4 children at that point, and I was making minimal amount of money, struggling to pay a $71 bill for rent that month. So you got to do it, though, because that's where you get the experience. That help you? Yes, hi.
Hi, thank you for being here. So you talked a lot about how difficult, schedule-wise, being a career litigator is with balancing, family and relationships and things like that. Can you speak a little more on how you have found ways to do that?
I would have said this answer if my wife wasn't here. Okay? And the answer is, you have to have a partner that is understanding. We went to college together. We went to law school together. We had children together, obviously. And you have to have somebody that understands. Because when the furnace exploded one day, I was on trial. I didn't learn about that furnace exploding until the weekend. And we've had other issues, and she took care of it, and I never knew. I have to tell you, because my head wasn't there. I would be up at 3:15 in the morning walking around. The dogs would look at me like, I'm not going out yet. So that's what you have to have. I can't give it to you any more than that. And that's from here, let me tell you. You had your hand up.
Thanks again for coming.
Sure.
What do you do with an opposing lawyer in deposition who is trying to get their client to not answer any questions?
Yeah. Let's talk about the obstreperous, pain-in-the-ass adversary. That seems to be what you're talking about. Let me talk for a minute about New Jersey and the rule on that. And we'll talk of federal rule if you want to get to it. There's only two reasons why you can direct the witness not to answer a question. One is the attorney-client privilege, and the other is incompetence. And therefore, what they have done with the rule is you basically have to answer. What I have done, I had a case in New York representing a judge's daughter, actually, a Superior Court judge, and she was heard very badly on the New York Thruway. And I was taking the deposition of the defendant truck driver. And I didn't know this lawyer. He came from a big firm. He was about my age. And I asked the question of the defendant truck driver, what's your name? Gave me his name. I said, "Where do you live?" I said, "Where did you get an education?" And he objects. "Why would you object to that?" "It's hearsay." I said, "It's what?" I said, "Okay." So I went on and asked another question about this, about that. "Did you see? Did you hear? Did you do?" You know. And he objects. And he objects. And he objects again. Okay, off the record for a moment. I said, "Counsel, could I see you outside for a moment?" I wasn't going to show him the tattoos. So I get him outside and I said to him, "Look, you and I have been in this business." I said, "I want to be obnoxious." I said, "That's fine. But you know I'm going to get the answers." I said, "I take a fast deposition. I know exactly what I want. I go in, slice, cut, and get out. I don't sew up. I slice." And I said, "My deposition of your client is going to be maybe 10 minutes. I said, by you doing what you're doing is creating a record for the judge to get mad at you. I mean, mad at you. Federal case, Southern District." And he said, "Well, you know, this is it." I said, "Please, I've been doing this more than 2 weeks. You have to answer the question. You don't want him to? Not a problem. So why don't we think about it for a moment? I'll go back and make believe I'm making notes. And let's see where it goes." "Well, okay." We go back in. 10 minutes later, the death was over. You have to do that. Nicely, privately, professionally. You have to do that. That's the only way I can recommend it. And if they continue to do it, create the record. That's what you got to do. Create the record, and you can use that record later. All right? Hi.
I have a question. Have you ever come across any issues regarding ineffective assistance of counsel?
As what? I'm sorry?
I guess in regards to reporting ineffective assistance of counsel or misconduct amongst your colleagues, and how do you... But how do you deal with that? Because these are your colleagues. Maybe you come across in an appeals case, or you come across a client that shares their counsel with you, and you're just completely outraged. Maybe because of your passion for the field, you want to help this person. how do you what do? You contact the ABA? Do you report them? Do you contact that specific attorney?
I have on my conscience something that I did many years ago. And that was, I was asked by the Central Ethics Committee to prosecute a lawyer who they felt had taken a lot of money, and they asked me to prosecute that case in the Ethics Committee. And what I did was, I sent my private investigator at my expense, they don't pay it for this, to go out and investigate what this lawyer claims as his defense. And everything that he had said on the answer filed to the complaint by the Ethics Committee, I gave to my investigator and I said, doesn't make sense. And lo and behold, we go back to the Ethics Committee and we try the case. And I destroyed him with the evidence that we had. He was a family man, had children. He was disbarred, not indicted, disbarred. And every time my wife and I drive by his office, to this day, I look at her and I say, I cannot forget what I did to Louis. And her comment to me always is, he was corrupt and he committed illegal acts and he was unethical in doing that. You did exactly what you were supposed to do. But I have to tell you, to this day, that still bothers me. I did the right thing. I had to do it. It still bothers me because I won. Therefore, if you see something that is unethical, you are under a rule obligation to report that to the ethics committee in the jurisdiction where that has happened. That's the ethical part. Your second part of your question dealt with the incompetence. That was the second part of the question. That's a different answer for this reason. The incompetence, a PCR, in post-conviction relief, you can apply for that using the incompetence of counsel. What I have seen is that the appellate courts are now taking a serious look at that, because some of the public defenders are so overwhelmed with work, in fairness to them, that they don't have the ammunition to do the proper investigation, to prepare for the trial, to present and interview witnesses. And therefore, the defendant who is convicted says, I didn't have competent counsel. No, they had competent counsel. But they didn't have competent counsel on this case because of the overwhelming amount of work that that person could not do and could not get to. That's not an ethics issue. That's a post-conviction relief issue. Right? Who's up? That's it?
You got one right there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you. Hi.
So I've heard that a frequent problem for
Yeah, that's a very good question. When I started doing this, I was told that after 5 years, I would either leave the trial world or become an alcoholic. And I don't mean that as a joke. I'm dead serious about that. You have to be prepared for an enormous amount of stress. And I just feel that the only way I can answer that candidly is you have to decide in your mind if you're prepared to give it that 100% commitment in whatever relationship you may have with a partner or a spouse or a friend, whatever, or children. It's very, very hard. It's very difficult to do it. And if you feel that you're losing it, then quite frankly, you got to get out because you can't do it 50, 60, 70%. You have to do it 100%. I had a case with a prosecutor, Meg Rodriguez, just a wonderful prosecutor. And we're in the middle of this very heavy trial. And she gets a note, and she looks at it, and I really like her. She's a great prosecutor. And I turn to her, and I write her a note. And I say, "Are you okay?" And she hands me the note. Jury doesn't see this. She hands me the note. And her son was just taken to the hospital on an emergency. So I said, "Your Honor, can we approach the bench?" And we're walking up. Jury's sitting there. We're walking up, and I said, "Hey, say something to him. Let's cancel the day." We go up, and we said to the judge, and she tells him the story. And he turns to her, and he says, "My wife died on a Friday." He says, "And Monday, I was back in court." He said, "We'll finish the day, and then you'll go to the hospital for your child." I turned to him, and I said, "Your Honor, that is just unfair." I said, "I can't proceed. I'm upset. I will drive her to the hospital. I'll get somebody to come up and finish the trial for the day." So sometimes people put on robes, and they get a little carried away with their health. You know, that God-like theory of who I am, don't you forget it. Does that help you? Okay, coming down. I don't want to take your question.
It relates to these students.
Uh-huh.
If you look at the audience here, it's, I think, more than a majority of women, future litigators. And when you were in law school here, I take it things were a little different.
I had one woman in my class.
And I wonder if you would comment on the problems and benefits of being a female litigator today, including any issues of gender bias that you see in the court.
There was just a judge that was not reappointed in New Jersey because of his gender bias towards women. And I said to him, I knew him, actually had my last name. Not related, but have on us. I went to him and I said to him, "You can't say these things in a courtroom." He said, "I'm only kidding." I said, "That's outrageous. Don't you understand? You can't say things like that." The problem that I see is that women have an enormous amount of work to do with a family. And they are lovingly, but unfairly, with the burden of handling an active trial practice and taking care of a family. I see it a lot where there's a deposition or a trial, and I get a call from an adversary, and she says to me, "Skippy, I have a sick child. I'm a single parent. I can't get a babysitter to come in all day. Can't take him to school." I have a witness that next day. What do you do? I say, "Whatever you want me to do, tell me what you want me to do." And you have to pay respect to that person. Women have a greater responsibility in professional fields than men do. And I know you guys are going to get pissed off at me, but I'm sorry, I see it that way. I was on the University of Medicine and Dentistry Board of Trustees for 27 years on and off. And as when I went to law school, and you know this law school was created by women for women. It's now back, because when I went to law school here, there was one woman in my class, and then when I graduated, there was two. And therefore, what happens is there has to be a commitment between a couple that the men have to take over some responsibility. The women want to be successful trial lawyers. Many of them are. There has to be that understanding. Because if it's fair for the man to avoid and commit working, studying, preparing, then why wouldn't it be that way for a woman? I hope that answers your question. Thank you, guys. You've been great.